Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 30. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who very generously pledged to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie and Noel. Thank you Raluca, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny G, Shah and Beth. A huge thank you also to Carol, Caroline, Sally, Haynes, Stephanie, Stacey and Callan. Thank you very much Marcus, Lauren, Denise, Can, Sandy and James. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before the end of April, and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a stunning Tudor Book of the Garden, donated by the lovely folk at Tudor Times Shop. Apart from being a practical garden journal, it's also a treasure trove of information about the Tudor garden and gardener. Further details available at shop.tudortimes.co.uk. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about disability and the Tudors is Philippa Vincent Connolly. Philippa is a secondary school teacher and historian who's currently working on several writing projects and towards her Masters in History through the Open University. She lives in Poole, Dorset with her two children. She's the author of Disability and the Tudors, which will be published in September 2020, and is part of the successful Tudor Dreams Historical Costumer Group. My conversation with Philippa straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Philippa. Please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself, including maybe what sparked your interest in Tudor history.
Okay. Hi, Natalie. My name's Philippa Vincent Connolly, and I qualified as a historian and secondary school teacher with a degree in history in 2011, and I'm currently studying an MA in history with the Open University in the UK.
So, Philippa, you've written a book called Disability and the Tudors, All the King's Fools. What inspired you to write this?
Apparently, I was the smallest surviving baby, premature baby, born in 1970. I was born at 26 weeks, weighing 1 pound, 2 ounces, which is about less than a bag of sugar.
Wow.
And yeah, no, it left me starved of oxygen, which led me being diagnosed with cerebral palsy. And cerebral palsy can affect the sufferer with severely or mildly disability, depending on how much or little oxygen they're deprived of at birth. Mm-hmm. So for me, being that small and being born that early, I was considered quite a miracle, really, because my legs were the only thing affected, whereas other people might have their speech affected, their arms and their hands and their mobility throughout their body affected. So I just ended up walking with a limp. And I've got atrocious balance. So doctors said I'd be in a wheelchair permanently by about the age of 10. So in the 1970s, disabled people were institutionalised, and I was until I was 9 years old. So we tended to be supported and looked after, given physiotherapy as well as, you know, an education. But I was one of the more able-bodied students in the school where I was. It was a boarding school, and it was run by the Shaftesbury Society. And I went into mainstream school eventually at the age of 9. My mum fought to get me out of that situation and to be educated with able-bodied people. And that was when I first came across the Tudors, because I was in a humanities lesson, and they were talking about Henry and his wives and their divorces and executions. And I was sort of fascinated by the fact that why would Henry actually decide to execute two women that he supported and supposedly loved? Why would he have done that? And it got me intrigued, and I sort of began reading lots of books from that time on in, from a young age. And I started reading fiction like Jean Plaidy.
Right, yeah.
And that's what got me interested in the period. And the reason why I chose to look at disability was not just because of my own life experience with disability, but I wanted to find out, how were disabled people treated in the past? Yeah. Because things have gone through full circle with disability lately, with the right-wing ideology and all those kinds of things. We're now in a situation where a lot of disabled people are no longer valued. We're again being put back in institutions, out of sight, out of mind. We're not nurtured and valued and cared for as we once were. That's when you look at all the policies that are coming forward and the lack of care and the lack of support that's happening. And it actually got me thinking about how the Tudors actually treated people with disability, because you don't hear about that.
No, not exactly. It's not something you hear about at all, really, is it?
No.
Fabulous. Well, that's a really good segue into the other question that I had for you, and that is, how were people with disabilities viewed and treated in Tudor times? Could you give us a little bit of a summary about that?
Yeah, the problem with disability history is that it's poorly documented.
Right.
Predominantly because disabled people constituted a large part of society, the peasantry, clergy and nobility, and they weren't really regarded as extraordinary. So their existence has been preserved through religious texts, state papers and medical journals. But the terminology and the categorisation of disabled people wasn't actually there at the time. So how we put compartmentalised disability now just wasn't around. So they would describe disabled people such as being blind, dumb, crippled, lame. Right. They were undistinguished from poor people in society, if that makes any sense.
Right, yeah.
And they were feared through superstition and religion, anything that was slightly different from the normal. But then you had this really weird juxtaposition where they're also honoured because of their difference and because of their disability. So it's a weird way of looking at it, but that's how it was. And so much so that they were cherished, particularly in royal courts, because their disabilities considered to bring them actually closer to God, because they were more or less suffering purgatory on earth.
That is really interesting. So was there any support for them? Was there anything, any support available to them?
They were supported by their families. The Tudors were very particular in family units and how families were in communities, and they basically wanted families to look after the disabled first and foremost. Then there were people who were philanthropists and humanists like Thomas More, who would look after disabled people and mentally handicapped people. And that was more done on a charitable sort of gesture. If family support wasn't available to them, this wasn't the rule though. It was basically a case of people like Henry Patterson, who some listeners may have seen featured in the Wolf Hall series, who basically was taken in by Thomas More and actually educated and brought up as if he was one of the family. That wasn't the normal case. And then there's religious houses, monasteries, hospitals and almshouses. Those were the main forms of charitable support. But the family and the community was the first stop, really, to disabled people having some kind of support.
Okay, thank you. Now, I know that you've researched the lives of some prominent people within the nobility who had physical disabilities or perhaps a mental illness. Could you tell us about some of them, some of the people that you've researched?
Yeah, sure. The first person I sort of decided to look at was Queen Claude of France. And I know that she's not a Tudor, but she had a lot of physical conditions.
Yeah.
And she was linked to the Tudors because, obviously, we know that Anne Boleyn went to serve her in France as well. And she was married to one of Henry VIII's long-term enemies.
That's true.
So, yeah, so Claude basically was known to have... 7 children, but she also suffered with scoliosis, which is the same as Richard III. She was rumoured to suffer with constant pain when walking and astigmatism in her left eye. And she had one leg shorter than the other. And obviously her pregnancies, she always had to cope with those. But she lived a very pious and honourable life. So I found that quite fascinating that, I suppose because of her royal status, her disabilities weren't exactly ignored, but she still managed to do her duty and do what was expected of her, which was to produce healthy heirs.
That's right.
And then we've talked about Thomas More with Henry Patterson, who More took the trouble of educating. There was records where Henry Patterson would debate issues with Thomas More over meal times after supper, and Patterson would advise him on the King's Great Matter and try and get More to slightly change his opinions to get a better outcome in discussion with the King. I found that quite interesting. There was Jane Fall, who is pictured in the family of Henry VIII portrait, which is along the Haunted Gallery at Hampton Court. She began life in the household of Anne Boleyn, and she had her head shaven 4 times. We don't know why, whether that was... just a form of showing her status, and she used to wear a coif over it all the time, but it cost them 4 pence every single time they shaved her head, and it's actually in the state records. And Anne Boleyn actually bought lots of clothing for Jane Fall as well, so she was obviously looking after her and trying to nurture her and support her. And I think that's really amazing. Shows Anne's compassion and her willingness to accept people with disabilities. So I found that really fascinating.
Absolutely.
After Anne's death, she was taken into Princess Mary's household. And then after that, she was taken into Catherine Parr's household. And it's documented that Catherine Parr actually bought Jane for some geese. And used to like walking around the gardens and looking after these geese like a shepherdess kind of thing. And I thought that was a really lovely thing. That's actually in the records. And the other thing that I like is that going back to Anne, Jane was in the coronation procession, and she actually told the crowd off. Told the mayor of London off because the people weren't raising their hats and cheering for the Queen as she passed, and she shouted at the crowd, and she said, look, have you got scurvy on your head, is that why you don't raise your hat? And to me, that just that just shows that she had possibly some kind of like Down syndrome, because those kind of disabilities, people just, they speak without thinking. They speak what's on their mind.
That's right.
And this is exactly what Jane Fall did in that particular instance. And I found that fascinating. I remember when I was scrolling through the records on British History Online, and I found it, and I was like, wow, this is really exciting to actually find this. And nobody ever really talks about her. So that was amazing to find that. And it smacks just me in the face, where it's like, yes, this was a person who did have sort of issues and did have possibly learning disabilities, mm-hmm. and she was so direct, and that's probably why she was so well liked and so well supported, because it didn't matter what she said, because they felt she was talking the truth all the time, and that's why she was so well loved.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah, and considering that all the rest of the courtiers are, you know, rarely telling the truth of being very direct,
exactly.
That must have been
very frightened too.
That's right, exactly. Fabulous. All right. So you mentioned Jane. So it'd be really wonderful if you could talk to us a little bit more about the people that were referred to as fools at the time and employed. Yep. And, you know, you've mentioned they were employed by the Tudor kings and queens. They were revered. Can you explain this term, sort of natural fool, that we see come up from time to time?
Yeah, well, there was basically two kinds of fool. And they were categorised by either being what we call an innocent or a natural fool. Mm-hmm. And that was somebody who had a learning disability or something like Down syndrome, which we've talked about with Jane. Mm-hmm. And then there was what we know as the court jester. So those were the two different types of fool. Okay, but a natural fool was somebody who, in a lot of cases, needed a carer or a keeper to look after them because they weren't able to look after themselves. And natural fools were looked up to and looked after in court and in a family situation because they didn't have to provide for themselves or even buy their own clothes. And they were actually, all their laundry was done for them, the preparing of their meals. And it was basically a situation where they were there to make people feel happy, to just spend time with, be a companion to maybe the king or the queen and their household, and everything, all their needs were taken care of for them. And the interesting thing is that Will Sommer, who is another one of the fools in the family portrait of Henry VIII, was dressed in expensive style clothing, green cloth, and that was the colour of a retainer or a servant. So he wasn't on the same level as a courtier, and his life, he wasn't expected to live like a courtier and go by the same rules. And so that's the difference. A court jester was basically someone who had a paid position. They were normally dressed in motley, and they used to have bells on their caps, so the traditional idea that we think of with fools. And their job was to be a part of court performances and plays and to make fun of other courtiers in the form of jokes. And they were different from natural fools because they put on their foolishness and they made jokes and made fun of other people's expense.
Thanks for clarifying that. So the natural fool, I suppose, they didn't receive, by the sounds of what you're saying, they didn't receive pay, but they were looked after and all their needs were, you know, covered. And
yes.
Excellent. Thank you. That's great.
That was the difference.
Yeah. Okay. So you've dedicated, I know, a lot of time to researching Henry VIII's health as well, especially towards the end of his life. And, you know, the fact that he was obese and plagued by festering leg ulcers is well known. But just how incapacitated was the king in his final years?
Well, we all know about the jousting accident of January 1536. That's been well documented, and it was reported by Ambassador Shapwe that Henry actually, the horse possibly fell on him, and it opened an old wound in Henry's calf and it incapacitated him from time to time, every time that it reopened. So it meant that Henry couldn't play sports like he used to do, and his lack of exercise combined with his poor diet and overeating led him to being immobile. and eventually physically disabled, because how can you possibly get around as you once did if you're in horrendous, horrendous pain and you've got this leaking wound that can't heal itself? So his physical challenges towards the end of his reign prompted Henry to ask his gentlemen in the Privy Chamber to help him invent a device to move him up and down 20 steps at Whitehall Palace, like a kind of stair lift, if you like, or a stair throne, which was described in the primary sources as a chair that goeth up and down.
Right, okay.
Couldn't find any image of the stair lift, but the device would have been like a block and tackle system that would have been used on something like the Mary Rose to get items in and out of the ship. Servants would have used this to pull the king's body up and down the stairs on a rope system.
Right.
Quite how you could see that working, I don't know, but I think it's quite ingenious of the Tudors to actually, you know, do something like that.
Nice.
And the other thing about this was that not only did he have a stair lift in his inventories, that he owned three wheelchairs or trams.
Right.
So you could imagine like a luxurious throne on wheels.
Mm.
So, you know, it was a way of getting the king around the palaces easier and faster, and enabled the king to not be in so much pain, because he was about 30 stone. Let's face it, trying to help sort of support somebody around the palace, if they're just leaning on you or they're on a cane, is going to take an awful long time to get from one side of the palace to another. So although we don't think of Henry VIII as being disabled, by the time he was in his 40s, 50s, he was getting that way. You know, like all of us, as we sort of begin to approach old age, you know, these things sort of catch up with us, and it did with Henry.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, you know, the young prince and the active sportsman and all that was kind of gone, wasn't it, after all those things started to plague him?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I find it quite incredible, having sort of look through that information, that he had, you know, a wheelchair and a stair lift. You know, it's just,
that is amazing.
The things that you find out, you know, there's always something new we can learn about the period, and that was quite amazing, I thought.
Absolutely, yeah. Like you say, ingenious for the time, definitely.
Yeah.
So Philippa, during you've done extensive research into the Tudor court, did you discover anything apart from the wheelchair and the stair lift that really surprised you, or that you were kind of a bit shocked about?
Yeah, well, the wheelchair thing was quite amazing. And the second thing, which I've touched on briefly before, was about Jane Fall being part of Anne Boleyn's coronation.
Yeah.
And the fact that she was actually in the procession shows just how important to the household she actually was, and how valued she was by Anne. And there's an anonymous source which explains during the procession how the crowd didn't take their bonnets off to cheer for the Queen. And it says, though it was customary to kneel, uncover and cry, "God save the King, God save the Queen," whenever they appeared in public, no one in London or the suburbs, not even women and children, did so on this occasion. Without permission during the coronation, Jane asked the mayor to command the crowd to make customary shouts, but the mayor replied that it was not down to him to change the hearts and minds of the people. He remarked that even if the king wanted to, even if he could not change their minds, he couldn't change their minds. Out of frustration and loyalty to Anne Boleyn, and seeing the little honour the crowd gave the queen, Jane cried out, "I think you all have scurvy heads and dare not uncover." Jane told the crowd off in no uncertain terms, probably scowling and shaking her fist as she did. Her reprimand was direct, yet we do not know if Jane, a natural fool, changed the crowd's behaviour. What is fascinating about this source, however reliable or unreliable it is, it shows what was expected, that the crowd would cry out to the Queen to show their fealty and loyalty. Yet with Anne, this didn't happen. There's a rumour that perpetuates today, which the crowd would pay to lift their hats and shout out tributes to the Queen. And Jane the Fool, she was thought to have Down syndrome, and she was picking up on the atmosphere of the crowd, as people with learning disabilities often do. She spoke her mind. The other illuminating point from the source is that the writer states that Jane was well travelled, she travelled to the holy city of Jerusalem, and that she was able to speak several other languages, which I found quite mind-blowing. So it can be implied from that Jane at some point had been educated and been cared for by other benefactors who could afford to travel. And perhaps I thought that maybe they were taking her to the Holy Land for healing.
Right, okay.
And perhaps the family looked after her were trying to cure her disability. That is another question. It's quite fascinating. The primary source also implies a feeling of loyalty between Jane the Fool, the servant, to that of her mistress Anne Boleyn. Although we don't know Anne Boleyn's motive, you know, it just shows her kindness and compassion that she took Jane into her household, cared for her and paid for her clothing and treated the young woman with every respect she could, just as Henry had done with Will Smut. You know, that's fascinating.
It does, shows another side to them, doesn't it? A very human side to
it does
to them. Definitely. And did you say that then she was employed in Mary's household?
Obviously, after Anne's untimely execution, Mary took her in and looked after her. And then for some reason, we don't know why, she went into the household of Catherine Parr, because then we have these records of Catherine Parr buying these geese. So, and then Jane completely disappears from the records.
Yeah, I wonder what happened to her. Another mystery. Yeah. All right, fabulous. This has been so enlightening. It is something that I think we don't hear about often enough, really. So I think it's fantastic what you've done. When is your book coming out?
It's September this year.
Oh, fabulous. Excellent. And are you currently working on any new books, Philippa, that you can tell us about?
Yeah, of course. I've been commissioned to write a biography on George Boleyn, which I'm working on at the moment.
Right.
And I've also been commissioned to write Disability in the Victorians, which is about Christian charity and also chastisement, which is incidentally the period that I'm covering for my MA in history.
Right, okay.
And then if the disability series is well received, I'm hoping to write books on disability in the Stuarts, because I found some evidence that possibly James the First could have had cerebral palsy.
Right.
Disability in the Georgians, which will be fascinating periods to look at. And on top of this, I've been working on a trilogy of Anne Boleyn, which is a fictional story. Mm-hmm. Something slightly different. Right. Obviously, I wanted to try and keep to the primary sources as much as possible, but it's basically a history student who manages to time travel through history. She goes back to Anne and back to the court, the Tudor court, and it's how she struggles with the dilemma of changing Anne's history. What would we do if we were plunged into that situation, knowing all that we know? Would we want to try and change the outcomes for Anne? Would we try and change the lives of other people if we had the opportunity to? And that's the dilemma I was looking at in the story. And the student has to cope with the sexual advances of other Tudor courtiers, even the king.
Right, okay.
And at the same time, she's also got to keep her identity secret. Everything she knows a secret. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's how I'm doing it, and I'm splitting it into three books, obviously, because there's lots of information there to cover and a long time period to cover. And at the moment, I'm looking for an agent or a publisher to take the project on, and I've completely finished volume one. I've got an amazing editor in Ireland who's working on it with me, hoping to get that out there as well. So in the future, I'm not only going to be offering academic writing, but something a bit fun as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got your hands absolutely full with all those writing projects.
Always.
Yeah, and I love to look, time travel, time slip type novels are my favourite, so I'm really looking forward to your series, definitely. It sounds fantastic. Yeah. So, Philippa, it is time for us to play our little game of 10 to go. So, are you ready?
Yes.
Excellent. All right. So, name two items that are on your bucket list.
Oh, what to do or to own?
Yeah, to do, to own, to learn. Anything that's on there is fine.
Oh, gosh. I would love to do a PhD on disability history and look at the disability of people in the royal family through a certain period.
Right.
That's something that's on my agenda, but not right now because I've got loads going on. but I'm going to start applying for those. So I think that would be really amazing to be able to do that I don't know whether I'm punching a bit too high, but I'm going to give it a go.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, yeah. What else? I mean, I've been to so many Tudor-related places in this country and so many times, but they never fail to impress and amaze me. Absolutely. And, you know, you were talking about the time slip thing.
Mm.
You know, sometimes for me, it's just like if you stand in like Wolsey's closet at Hampton Court Palace,
oh, yeah,
and there's nobody, yeah, in there, and it's nice and quiet, and you can just sit or stand in there and just close your eyes for a minute and try and imagine some of the conversations that must have gone on in that room. That's the sort of thing that I find really fascinating. And that's what keeps drawing me back to revisit these places over and over again, even though I've been there so many times. That's the sort of thing I love to do. Possibly having an opportunity to work in somewhere, Hampton Court Palace, doing something would be amazing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wouldn't that be a dream?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things that I'd love to do.
Fabulous. Excellent. So what do you do? You're obviously extremely busy. You're doing a lot at the same time. So what do you do to recharge?
Actually, go out and visit these places. And, you know, that just gives me sort of like a bit of quiet, you know, sometimes in some points in the day to be able to reflect on things. And the other thing that I do that you've probably seen on Facebook is I work a lot with Gina Clark from Tudor Dreams Historical Costumier. And we go out and reenact, and we dress up as Tudors and all that sort of thing. And we talk to people about the costumes and the history, and it's all done nice and lightheartedly. Mm-hmm. It's not done really seriously. It's just to get people engaging with the history when we're at certain places, to for them to get an idea. It brings the places alive when we walk around, so that's quite interesting to do. And we're actually going to Versailles this year, dressed up, Marie Antoinette and her entourage. And I've never been to Versailles, so that's a huge thing on my bucket list. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to cope with all the walking, but it's just like to be in that particular palace is just going to be absolutely incredible. I think I'm going to be stood there with tears rolling down my cheeks because I'm there, you know.
Absolutely.
It just makes it so tangible when you stand in these places and you can actually see where things all happened. I just find that incredible.
Yeah, look, I'm with you. That's what's inspired most of my work for the last decade, so I totally agree with you. What's a favourite holiday destination?
Because I'm so busy, I don't often get to go on holiday.
Oh, that's all right. Where would you like to go?
Where would I like to go? Versailles is one of them. Paris is one of them. I've never actually been. I've been to Disney World, but you know, in Paris, but that's it. I never went to the city. I would love to go to New York for the culture and the museums and all that kind of thing. I've actually never ever been there, so those are two destinations I'd like to go to. And the other place that I would like to go to, which I've never been to, is Edinburgh.
Well, yes, another wonderful city.
It's local, and obviously if I decided to do disability in the Stuarts, then I'm going to have to trawl all the way up to Edinburgh and have a look at the Stuart palaces and immerse myself in that part of history as well. So I've been to Glasgow and I loved it. I went there as a teenager and loved it because we had family friends up there, but I've never been across to Edinburgh, so I think that would be a really nice place to visit.
Definitely. I think you'll love all those three places you've just mentioned there. Philippa, describe your ideal Saturday night.
Well, usually I've got my two teenage boys with me.
Yes.
They are generally set on the Xbox or the PlayStation in their room playing games, or they're out with their mates. I will tend to sit and put some candles on, have a nice bottle of wine, and sit and watch a good history documentary, or try and find something on History Hit to watch, or watch a really good film on TV. If anybody hasn't seen it, try and get to watch The Favourite about Queen Anne, because that's all filmed around in some of the Hampton Court Palace corridors and passageways and rooms and everything, and down in the kitchens. And it's a really amazing film. It might not be completely accurate, but I absolutely loved it. It's a bit like Marmite. You either love it or hate it as a film, but, you know, I like to do things like that.
That sounds fantastic. I love that. I imagine that you read lots of books as well, somewhere in there. I don't know how you do it all, really.
I've got, I have got so many books. I am actually running out of shelf space. It's getting ridiculous.
I can imagine. So what's a book that's currently on your bedside table at the moment?
Oh gosh, and The Black Tudors,
Oh yes, yeah.
which is by Miranda Kaufman. I haven't started reading it yet, but I'm going to, and because I think again that's another period in sort of Tudor history which has been overlooked, like disability history. So I've got that to read. I've just got so many books to read. I'm really fortunate that a lot of my books have been signed by the authors where I've met them at one time or another, or and so they're quite precious to me. Another book I've got is a facsimile book of a copy of Anne Boleyn's Book of Hours,
Oh,
which is
nice.
absolutely tiny, and the pages are just so beautiful with the illuminations on them. And that's a book that I love to sit and open occasionally and have a look at. I've got lots of books to read, mostly non-fiction, and I like to look at those first because that I think is more informative than fiction. Sometimes with fiction you have to pick through what's what's true and what's not.
Yeah.
And I've got the new book by Laura McKay on Thomas Boleyn and George Boleyn to read as well.
Yeah.
I've got all sorts of books that I've got to get my teeth into. I'm looking at satire at the moment to do with Fools of the Tudor Court as well, and reading Armin and Brahms and people like that. So that's what I've got myself stuck into at the moment. And another book that I really love the writing style of, and I found really enjoyable to read, is the book by Tracy Borman on Henry VIII and the Men Who Made Him.
Oh, yes.
Her writing style is lovely, and I'm halfway through that at the moment as well. So I've got lots of things on the go.
It's exactly like I do the same thing. I have several things happening at the same time. Philippa, what's a favourite childhood movie or book, something you loved as a young person?
Oh gosh, I used to watch films so much when I was little. Jean Plaidy, obviously, I really loved reading because that's what got me into the Tudors and into history in the first place. And I think that at 9 years old, it was quite ambitious for me
Wow,
to read
that
a
is
lot of her
ambitious.
books. But that's what I did. I absolutely absorbed everything she wrote and loved it. Some of it, looking back, I don't think I quite understood everything that was going on in them. But it gave me such an empathy and a compassion for some of these people with everything they go through. I mean, especially when you read, Anne Boleyn going to trial, and like you want to shout. I wanted to shout the people in the room, she's not guilty,
Oh,
she's
I
not.
know.
And having that understanding when you're so little, that was just how it was. I just read all of those books, and Anne of a Thousand Days, we've all watched that hundreds of times over and over until we've sort of worn the VHS out on it, and those kinds of things, So it's always fiction that tends to get a lot of people into the history in the first place, but that's not a bad thing because it then gets us researching more, looking into the lives of these people, and looking into the primary sources about these people, and having a greater understanding. So any fiction and films, I think, is fantastic to do that.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. So that leads nicely into another question I wanted to ask you. Did you always want to be a historian and a writer, or did you have some other aspirations when you were a child?
This is going to make you laugh now. I actually either wanted to be a nurse
Right.
or I wanted to be a ballerina. Now,
Okay.
don't laugh at the ballerina thing. I had a fascination with pointe shoes,
Right.
and I loved the way dancers moved. But then, of course, I wouldn't have been able to dance at all with, I can't even run, for goodness sake. And the nursing thing, just physically, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I wouldn't have been able to lift people out of bed. My balance is atrocious. I would have been a nightmare as a nurse. I might have been good as like my bedside manner and comforting people and plumping up their pillows and all that kind of stuff. But anything other than that, no. And then when I left school, I went to art college. I did 2 years of fashion design, and I started to design and make clothes. I started a degree. It was my first time away from home. I was in Leicester. It was a bit of a culture shock. Got glandular fever the first term I was there. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to do corsetry and lingerie design because that was the only course that actually did it in the entire country. And they ended up putting me back into fashion. And I really didn't want to be there. I was really unhappy. And I came home. And I ended up working in a bank for 6 months, which was the most boring experience of my entire life. and then I went on to do beauty therapy. And so I ended up teaching beauty therapy. I ended up having my own nail salons. I taught nails at colleges. I had some of my nail art and nails put into magazines. I got as far as I possibly could with that profession. And then I got divorced and I thought, right, I've got to close the business down. I need to do something else. And I became a teaching assistant, and I was working in a school down the road from me, a secondary school, and they put me into the history department with his most amazing teacher, who whenever you were sat in his lessons, he absolutely brought history to life, and the students absolutely loved him to bits and learnt so much. And while I was working with him and the rest of the other teachers in the department, I started my degree in history with the Open University, because you could do it long distance, you know, and do all your essays and things online and then email them in. And that's how I did it over 3 or 4 years while I was working in this particular school. But I learned so much from this particular teacher, probably more so than when I was on my degree. And he would walk around the classroom and he would just chuck bits of paper at me and resources at me and books at me and say, there you go, Philippa, have a look at that. And he'd sometimes read some of my essays and he'd point me in other directions to go down and make my essays better. He was absolutely incredible, absolutely adored being in his lessons. And then I thought, well, I loved being in the environment of teaching, and I found that my disability actually made me more approachable to the students who were, let's say, a bit more challenging.
Right, okay.
Had special needs, who had physical issues or behavioural issues and things at home, and they'd end up coming to me with problems and bits and pieces, and I thought, well, surely I should be able to become a teacher. And so I got my history degree done, and unfortunately the Open University didn't do a PGCE in history, so I couldn't actually get the qualification that said I was a proper history teacher. I had to do a PGCE in textiles and fashion because I'd previously had that knowledge, which was fine. So I ended up training to be a fashion and textiles teacher, and I've just really gone through my last proper government qualification for it, just finished about a month ago, which is fantastic. And now, as long as I can prove on my CV and with all my experience and with my knowledge and with my, that's one of the reasons why I'm doing my OA, school should then take me on to be able to teach history. So while I wasn't doing my NQT, which was my final teaching qualification, I was doing supply teaching.
Yes.
And during that time, I was teaching a lot of history as well. So I've got that experience, but it's just convincing a head teacher that I've got enough experience and don't need it to be like the letters after my name that I am a history teacher. You know, I've still got my teaching qualification, and regardless of subject these days with teaching shortages and how things are in education, as long as you can prove you can actually do the job, there's no reason why I can't teach history. So that's what I'm aiming for, is to be able to teach history in secondary school. So it's not just covering the Tudors, it's covering 20th century history, so both the wars, the interwar years, everything. So I also know quite a lot about that too. So
excellent. Well, I'm sure you'd be a very inspiring history teacher and very knowledgeable as well. What is your favourite kind of music, Philippa?
I absolutely love the 80s. I am an 80s girl at heart, but I am not like the typical Wham! Duran Duran type person. I am not that way inclined. I was a bit of a goth when I was at school.
Right.
So I had very black hair, very crimped hair, lots of eyeliner. Used to wear my granddad's old dinner jacket, evening jacket that he used to wear to his Freemason dues, with a great big crucifix, tie-dye tops underneath, and buckle boots and all sorts of stuff. I was quite wacky as a teenager. And so I used to listen to things like Soft Cell, Mark Almond. I still do absolutely love Mark. I've seen him in concert several times. Touched his hand and never got over it. Culture Club, I love. So all of those kinds of music, from like the obscure stuff, Depeche Mode, The Cure, all of those, all the weird and wonderful stuff from the 80s that often gets ignored, the New Romantic Movement, Gary Numan, all of those. But I also like listening to Mozart, classical music. Got a very eclectic taste. Phil Collins, Simply Red, got a very wide-ranging taste in music. And you were saying about a film that I love to watch. Yeah. Amadea is a great film to watch, especially with the music in it and the opera, and Marie Antoinette with Kirsten Dunst in it. Yes. I love it because of the operatic music in that. So I've got a very wide taste in music.
Yeah, sounds like it. That's fabulous. Now, Philippa, lucky last question. What do you think is the secret to a happy life?
Doing what you love. Doing what you love. Having a passion for what you love to do and sharing it with other people and making people happy through that. That's
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Now, we're coming to the last thing in our podcast today, and that's what we call our tutor takeaway. So it's a little gem for us to go and explore or check out after the episode. So do you have a tutor takeaway for us?
My tutor takeaway is going to be to delve into British History Online.
Lovely.
Because the primary sources are absolutely fascinating, because it really immerses you into the period and you find some really amazing tidbits about things you didn't know anything about. Like, for example, Sir Henry Norris, who was connected to Henry as Groom of the Stool, he has a connection to Poole Harbour, which is the largest natural harbour, or the second largest natural harbour in the world.
Right.
He was actually connected to Poole Harbour, which is near where I live. And Sir Thomas Wyatt, the poet, is buried at Sherborne in Dorset, which is not too far down the road from me. So, you know, it's amazing. Local history is also fascinating. We always tend to look at national stuff, but when you look at local history, you find some incredible bits of information, and it helps you to see your local area in a slightly different way, from a different viewpoint. And that's what my MA is looking at, is combining local and national history together, which is really good. The other thing that I find really amazing is the fact that anybody can go into the British Library and the archives at Kew and see any of the documents that we write about in the flesh. And there's nothing like holding a tangible document in your hand that's been written 500 years ago. For example, I went to see Anne Boleyn's indictment, and what people don't often mention when they look at that, when you lift up the 26th page of that document, underneath there is a leather bag that you can actually see the stitching where it's been sewn together. This was a bag that held all those documents within them, which is why the document's known as the Bag of Secrets.
Right.
And what I found so amazing was that this bag is so intact, and this, you can clearly see the stitches. It was obviously like a white or a creamy leather. It's discolored over time, obviously, because of its age. But I just found that absolutely fascinating. And I suppose from my textiles sort of point of view, that it was like, wow, this has survived
that
time.
Gosh.
You know, that you, and you don't get to hear about that when you're writing about these things. But actually seeing it, holding it, is incredible. And like when you you can see where the Duke of Norfolk has jabbed the quill of his pen his ink into the paper,
right,
where he's signing off the jury as they come in, you know, as they're sworn into the proceedings. And it's like you wonder, is he doing that because he's really doesn't want to be here and he's frustrated with the whole process, and is he wondering whether he can actually go through with what he's got to do, or is he doing it because he's like indignant and wants to get it over and done with? You know, it's like things like that are just so fascinating to me.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely mind-boggling, really, isn't it? When you think, of the very moment when that happened, what was going on? Goodness. Absolutely fascinating. And the great thing about the British History Online website that you've mentioned is that, of course, the Tudors, there are fans of the Tudors all over the globe. And so if you don't happen to be in England or in London to access those primary sources, of course, you can delve into them online, which is fantastic from your own home. You only need an internet connection and that's it. So that's a wonderful, wonderful takeaway. Thank you so much, Philippa. And thanks for chatting Tudors with me today, talking Tudors. It's been wonderful.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Natalie. It's been such a pleasure.
An absolute pleasure. And I wish you all the best of luck with all your projects. I can't wait to hear more, and with your job search as well. I can't wait to see that post where you say, yay, I'm a history teacher.
I know. I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, definitely. Keep going. All right. Thank you so much. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.